Coming up next on People Rise Up, an hour about food security. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO in Portland. As always, that's a little bit of music from Hamza Lila. And this program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. More information is available at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. So welcome to the show. We're going to be talking all about food security today. We got an hour to do it. We're going to have several folks involved. First, I'll be speaking with Danielle Murray. She is a staff researcher at the Earth Policy Institute. And let's just welcome her, and I'll mention the other folks in a second. Welcome to you, Danielle.
Good morning. On the East Coast here, anyway.
Right, right. And we'll talk to Danielle for about half the show, and then we'll have Andy Fisher from the Community Food Security Coalition and Matt Emlin from the Food Policy Council of Portland's Office of Sustainable Development, talking about how we can fix some of the things that Danielle will be describing and what's going on sort of regionally, nationally, and Matt will talk about specifically here in the Portland area. Now, Danielle, you wrote a paper called Oil and Food, a Rising Security Challenge, that came out in early May for the Earth Policy Institute. And just real broadly, can you kind of lay the picture of the relationship between oil and food for folks? And with oil, I would also say include natural gas, please.
Sure. Well, what we're seeing with the U.S. food system is that every year food is undergoing more processing and traveling farther and farther. And so the food system is consuming ever more energy each year. That energy is being used on the farm. I think that's what most people think of is, you know, the diesel and gasoline and natural gas being used at the farm level for agricultural production. But what we're actually finding is that that's becoming an even smaller fraction of the total. That consumes about a fifth of the energy in the system. The other four-fifths are actually coming between when the food leaves the farm and when it gets onto your plate at home. So that's being used to transport, process, package, sell, and store the food after it leaves the farm.
Yeah, and in looking at the data, and I am actually looking at the graph that breaks out the what you just described, initially I was really surprised that home refrigeration and preparation consume about one-third of the energy used in our food system. But then I really thought about it, and it's like, okay, well, there's probably a whole lot of really inefficient refrigerators out there still. There's the whole issue of, well, I guess it's home refrigeration, so it's not talking about trucks and planes. And then a lot of people probably still cook on electric stoves, which are significantly less efficient to use than a gas stove.
Right.
And I was also surprised at how low the percentage was for just kind of strict transport. It's about 1/7.
Right.
But it's growing, as you said.
Yeah, that is a huge problem, actually. Transport of food, if you think about it, last time we went to the grocery store, looking at the stickers on your fresh produce, you're probably seeing produced in Chile, produced in New Zealand, you know, your apples, your grapes, even South Africa these days. And for the most part, that's coming in by ship on barges. But a somewhat disturbing trend we're seeing is that more and more is actually being shipped in by these refrigerated jumbo jets, which are 60 times as energy inefficient as shipping by sea. They use massive amounts of energy, both for the cooling of the plane and, of course, for sticking that jumbo jet up in the sky in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a very small portion of how our food gets here, but it's growing, and it's just a glimpse of kind of the way Americans and others look at the food as something we can get from anywhere whenever we want it. It's available. And
that's really only the past 20 years or so, sort of like the early to mid 80s, if I remember from,
certainly.
You know.
And even more recent than that, it's really just beginning to take off.
And chances are it'll be a somewhat short-lived phenomena if even some of the more conservative projections regarding the oil peak, whenever that happens, on the downside, things like, you know, fresh apples from New Zealand, when apples aren't available here, it's just not going to happen.
Right, and it's a wonderful thing that we can be able to get it, but it's just not the most energy efficient system in the world. And even here in the States, you know, most of our produce is coming from California, and if you're living in Portland, that may not be such a problem, but if you're on the East Coast, it means that most of your food is already traveling about 3,000 miles before it gets to you. And even if that's coming by rail or barge, that's using quite a bit of energy, but about 90% of our food is shipped by truck, by refrigerated truck. And once again, refrigeration is a huge energy drain, either in the home or when you're transporting. So that's using a lot of energy. Just putting the diesel in the truck to get it here is also a large large consumer of oil. And so it's really a source of insecurity in our food system, and that oil is coming, for the most part, from abroad, from the Middle East. And as you say, peak oil may be approaching, may already be here some say. And we aren't going to have this unlimited cheap fuel supply forever. And so what are we going to do when that oil is not readily available, and
we still need to
be costing a lot more to be bringing those food items 3,000 miles to get it to us.
Now, the concept of food miles is something that has kind of gained traction in many aspects of activism related to food, and that's sort of real simply defined as, you know, how far does the food ultimately travel, I guess, once grown to the consumer, and I suppose to the extent that seeds are purchased and other inputs are purchased, driven to the farm, that would have to be factored in somehow. But most simply, it's, you know, food is harvested and delivered. Mm-hmm. The United Kingdom Department of, EFRA, I forget. Anyway, I guess it's the Department of the Environment, Rural and Something Affairs Division just put a paper out all about food miles in the UK, and my
giant
website.
Problem in the UK because they're an island; they don't have a lot of food production right there.
Right, but at least they are significantly smaller. And I'll have a link up to that. It was kind of fascinating, and they don't define food miles the way I just did. They took a much larger perspective on the issue. Your report, Oil and Food, from May of this year, says that fruits and vegetables in Western industrialized countries often log 1,550 to 2,480 miles, so 1,500 to 2,500 miles from farm to store, which is significantly higher than numbers I've always heard, which is about 1,000 to 1,500. So I'm curious, were the earlier numbers accurate at the time and that's changed, or were there really no good hard numbers and people made a guess of, you know, about 1,000.
Right. Well, these are numbers coming out of the World Watch Institute, a researcher named Brian Howell, who's written an excellent book on the subject called Eat Here. But, you know, it is obviously an imprecise measure. It's a question of, you know, differing ways of calculating it. But if you're talking on the level of 1,000 versus 2,000 miles, it's still, regardless of the nuances, it's a huge problem. And it's the point is the food is traveling very far before it gets to you. I can't tell you exactly which is the more precise number, but
okay,
they're both very large and upsetting from a food security point of view.
Now, one of the large reasons why food is transported, well, I guess there's a couple. First, there's more money to be made if you have to ship something a tremendous distance as opposed to just having it supplied locally, which is this kind of weird, perverse aspect of our economic system, I think. And then there's this whole shift in, oh, I don't know, I guess maybe 30 years or so, this really tremendous shift toward processed convenience foods as sort of the norm, as opposed to, you know, kind of like a special thing that you did once in a while.
Right.
Is that true? Is that a seriously contributing factor to the distance food travels?
Certainly. And if not the distance the food travels, then the processing is adding large amounts of, you know, energy use to the system. If you think about our parents or even our grandparents, most of them lived probably on farms. They had local farms where they bought their foodstuffs, or, growing it in the backyard was more of an option back then. Nowadays, fewer people have them. And, of course, plenty of us don't live in regions where you can have fresh food out of your backyard all year round. So there's the convenience of going to the grocery store and buying food that was brought in from who knows where. But it's also becoming, yes, a question of buying more, not just coming from elsewhere, but much more heavily processed food, packaged. You know, you buy something at a store that's in a bag, that's in a box, that's then shrink-wrapped, things like that. Really heavily processed foods, like ready-to-make dinners, just heat up and serve, those kinds of things. So it is a question of convenience. But there's also just been the shift in our overall food system from buying from your neighborhood farmer, or from getting food from your own farm or your own garden, to bringing it in from these big farms that are located elsewhere, if not in your state, perhaps elsewhere in your country, and even elsewhere in the world. And instead of just going from the farmer straight to the consumer, now what we're seeing is that it goes from the farm to, say, a distributor who brings it to another processor, who then sends it back to another distributor who sends it to
the wholesaler,
grocery stores, right, to wholesalers, and then to individual grocery stores or restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, the consumer goes to the grocery store, which is often one of these, you know, superstores we have now out in the suburbs or wherever that you have to drive to and use more energy on your own to get to, and then take home and stick in the refrigerator often because it's not fresh and it's not going to keep for a long time sitting on your counter. And so throughout that whole process, you're adding miles, which adds to the petroleum needs for the trucks, and you're adding to refrigeration costs and energy needs, and you're including middleman after middleman from the processor to the distributors that really are unnecessary in a lot of ways, but it's become part of our system, and a lot of people do appreciate that convenience and having this nice homogenous supply of perfect-looking apples or perfect-looking lettuce. You know, it's something that we really, as consumers, have supported and encouraged, and the place where it needs to change, perhaps, is with those consumers.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. Danielle Murray is my guest at the moment. She's a staff researcher with the Earth Policy Institute. And we're talking a little bit about the U.S. food supply system and its energy use, and how that relates to how secure our food supply is. Let's back up to something that I wanted to mentioned before we got into food miles, and it made really no difference which order we did this in, but this is use of energy on the farm itself. We talked about kind of more broadly what type of distribution energy or how energy is used in the food system in general. And part of that, the 21%, I guess the 21% of agricultural production then turns into this graph on the back about farm energy use, or anyway, something close to that.
Right.
And I, again, really surprised to see that 30% of farm energy use, and this is 2002 numbers, is related to fertilizer production. Now, it
right.
seems like, and I'm just guessing, you know, methane, petroleum-derived, nitrogen-based and ammonia-based fertilizer. And it seems like that's a tremendous opportunity for saving energy use if we just kind of got back to revitalizing soil through natural processes as opposed to petroleum-based.
Definitely. And I do want to say, first of all, that farming agriculture actually has shown marked improvement in energy efficiency over the last decade or so. There's actually been significant improvements in fertilizer production, making that more energy efficient, and on-farm methods such as increasing the use of conservation tillage and drip irrigation, but there's plenty of room for improvement. And so, like you said, the biggest drain right now is coming from that fertilizer use, synthesizing nitrogen from the atmosphere to make this fertilizer for our soil uses very large amounts of natural gas. That's the majority of this energy use in fertilizer production. The other problem is that some of the other nutrients, such as potash or whatnot, is coming from rock deposits on the other side of the world in mm-hmm. Morocco or China or Russia. And mining is, of course, another very energy-intensive industry. And so there's not only energy use there, but, of course, environmental destruction associated with it. And altogether, you're bringing that back and sticking it in the soil as what some refer to as synthetic or industrial fertilizer, when the real problem is that we're taking these nutrients out of the soil in kind of a linear system and taking the food out, taking the crop, sending it to consumers, and then our waste is going to the landfill or even worse into water bodies through the sewage system or whatnot. And so what we'd really like to see is a more circular system where those organic wastes are being returned to the soil where they're needed, and so we could really decrease this use of industrial fertilizer and synthetic fertilizer.
Now, the final thing I'll mention that I was surprised about regarding food system energy use, and in specific here, farm energy use, is how little energy use was involved in irrigation. You have just 7%, and I know that there's some really tremendous water projects out west here, and maybe they're not irrigation oriented. But that's just really surprising. It seems like maybe an oil-deficient future wouldn't have as much of an impact on irrigation as, say, fertilizer.
Actually will have an effect on the both. Irrigation, it might seem a bit small, but most farms, actually the majority, don't use irrigation to a large extent anyways.
Okay.
So it really varies on a farm level. If you are one of those farms, say, in the Central Valley of California that's using a lot of irrigation water, your energy costs for irrigation are going to be much higher than someone else who is not, who has rain-fed crops.
Does that correlate reasonably well with the size of the farm you're operating?
Or I think it has more to do with location, and if you are lucky enough to be somewhere with that rain.
So like if you're in the desert but near a river.
Right.
Okay.
And so irrigation is, for the most part, it's either being pumped in, like you said, through these massive waterworks like you see in California with the aquifers, or it's being pumped from underground. And this is one of the biggest problems right now because we're actually seeing worldwide aquifer depletion. Water tables are dropping, actually, under most of the major crop-producing areas in the world, China, the U.S. And as those water tables drop, farmers have to use even stronger pumps, basically, to get that water up to the surface. And as they have these stronger pumps available, they're taking more water out because in part they can, and this water is available to them. So more and more energy as the water tables drop is being used for irrigation, for pumping that water up to the surface. So it's really a nasty cyclical situation in that you're using more water and depleting our water resources, and in the process using more and more energy.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it sort of mirrors what's happening in terms of oil production as well, with the reinjection of seawater to repressurize wells to get more oil out. Mm-hmm. You mentioned declining production, and I just want to let folks know that I guess it's Lester Brown there at the Earth Policy Institute and formerly of World Watch, who's done a bunch of research regarding world grain production. And, I guess actually some of this is from the report you did. Tons of grain production per ton of fertilizer use.
Right.
For several countries over the years. And you look at 1960 to 2004, and really since 1980, world grain production per ton of fertilizer use has been flat. It's declined slightly, but it's flat. And this millennium, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, if I'm remembering correctly, those were the four lowest. Okay, maybe I don't remember. What was significant about those 4 years that we fixed slightly last year in terms of grain production?
Well, world grain production for fertilizer use has actually declined since the 60s. And in the U.S., it's a better picture. We actually have stayed pretty much level. You know, jigsaw's a little just due to grain production levels, which has more to do with, say, the rain that we got that year, things like that, environmental factors. But for the most part, American farmers use fertilizer quite efficiently. We're putting on the level we need. We're using more precise monitoring of the soil to see exactly how much fertilizer we do need. The problem we're seeing is places like China, who kind of just keep pouring on the fertilizer and aren't seeing the gains in grain production. And hopefully that will end soon and they'll start to equilibrate. We're maybe seeing that in India in the last few years. But it's really, since the Green Revolution, we've had this idea that, you know, just add more fertilizer, and we'll get more out of it. But there's only so much it can do for us. And so that number is going to have to come down, the fertilizer use in some of those countries that are over-applying, and that will come through better technology, like I said, of precision nutrient monitoring of the soil, things like that.
And you, the listener, might be thinking, why am I concerned about how much grain China or India produces? I don't eat grain from China or India. You don't know what's in processed products. I'm sure there's mixing from all sorts of sources. But another issue is if China continues with food shortages, and I believe they have a slight grain shortage currently, if they start looking to import on the world market because of the quantity involved, because of the amount of people involved, they individually as a country can significantly rise or cause food grain prices to rise globally. And we've seen some of that in the past few years. I don't know if people have noticed how basic commodities like wheat and rice in bulk have gotten significantly more expensive than just a few years ago, but that's a little bit of what's going on.
Exactly. And so the problem is partly population increases. I mean, that the more people, the more grain we need, the more mouths to feed. But the bigger problem right now, actually, is that, for example, China, of course, they've got the biggest population, so you tend to focus on them. They have a booming economy, and they've got a lot of people moving up into this middle class. And like their American counterparts, they want to eat like we do. They want to eat more meat, more, you know, protein. And so what we're seeing is that as you increase your protein intake, most likely you're increasing the grain needed to use that. For example, Americans consume per person four times as much grain as the average Chinese person does. And that's not because we're eating four sacks of rice a person every day. It's because we're eating a lot more meat, a lot more beef, which takes a lot of grain to produce. Producing a quarter pounder of beef takes a lot more grain and also a lot more water than it does to produce a quarter pound of chicken, and a lot more than it does to produce the same amount of protein from, for example, a herbivorous fish species like tilapia or catfish, or from soybeans. And that's not actually to say that necessarily soybeans or other vegetarian sources are the most efficient protein source. We actually see that chicken and fish are pretty close in terms of the grain needed and the water needed. But, you know, things like beef and pork really skyrocket those grain demand needs. So as more and more Chinese, billions, in fact, of Chinese people move into this higher market and start demanding this high-quality protein meat, it puts incredible stress on our grain production system. And that is going to, of course, increase prices because we don't have a lot of land to be expanding agricultural production onto, and we don't have big grain surpluses anymore. So it's really something to watch in the next few years, and we really might be forced with this question of can we feed everybody, or can we feed everybody the way Americans are eating right now, or the way an average person in India is eating right now, or can we all kind of have somewhere in the middle, like most Europeans, like Italians on their Mediterranean diet, tend to eat somewhere kind of in between us in terms of how much grain they're consuming per person.
If you're interested in any of what Danielle Murray from the Earth Policy Institute's been talking about this morning, you should check out her paper at www.earth-policy.org. There's also a link to that paper on the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Danielle, to provide a little bit of context regarding food, energy, and the security of our food supply system.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
You too.
And I will be back in a few minutes with Andy Fisher from the Community Food Security Coalition and Matt Emlin from the Office of Sustainable Development here in Portland, the Food Policy Council, and more coming up, so do stay tuned. This is People Rise Up on KBOO.
Need some food in my belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. You know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food, working those lands for corporations. Don't do hungry people no good, cause people need food. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. A need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right to cut the trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat? You know those trees, they hold the topsoil. And those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protects them, put tax dollars where they need to be. Cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the dry in their throat. They need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same. Have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in the throat. The need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. $100 billion on defense, planning new ways to blow each other around. But even 1% of that budget could stop a whole lot of hungry sound. People need food in their belly, need some drink for the dry in their throat. They need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Got to have food. Kind of makes me wonder if we're gonna stay afloat.
And that's there, our good friend Brian QTN with food. And God, if I only knew what his website was. You can send him email at qtnity@hotmail.com. Oh, actually, here it is. www.qtnrg. That's all those separate letters, .org.